take a lesson from Johnny Larch.
I don't know Johnny Larch.
Johnny Larch got out after 5 years. He gets to the airport, hands his ticket to the woman at the counter who asks for his driver's license. She says it's expired. He says it might not be a valid driver's license, but it's a damn fine identification. There's my picture. Now wait, my hand. Who the fuck you think it is? She says, I'll thank you for not using that sort of language with me, sir. She says, give me my fucking boarding pass right fucking now. Now, he has the right to take that tone. She was disrespecting him. You won't let people disrespect you in prison? Why the fuck would you let her disrespect him as a free man? Mm-mm. She hit a button. Security shows up. He's back in prison. You understand what I'm saying right now?
One of those behaviors that work inside a specialized environment such as a prison can fail to work when outside such an environment.
No, dummy. I'm saying do not get off those bitches in airports.
Welcome to Storm of Spoilers. You've stumbled upon an 8-episode miniseries dedicated to the Starz series American Gods. I'm Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Gail Folsom.
Each week, we, two book readers and amateur Neil Gaiman experts, will unpack the latest episode of American Gods. Despite the name of this podcast, we will not be spoiling anything this episode beyond Season 1, Episode 2, The Secret of Spoons, directed by David Slade and written by Brian Fuller, Michael Green, Maria Melnick, and, of course, Neil Gaiman. Before we dive into this week's episode, let's check in on some listener feedback that we got. Gail, who had something to say this week?
Well, we had two very interesting theories about something we brought up in the first episode, which was the number 206. In the book, the technical boy refers to his like thug bouncer creations as being the children. And in the book, he says there are 206 of them. And I thought, well, Neil Gaiman being Neil Gaiman, there has to be a significance to that number. So we sort of threw it out to you listeners, and we came back with two very interesting theories. Matthew Pagel says, he writes in, first of, huge fan of the show. It's a great discussion and makes the workday pass a little quicker. Thank you. Just a quick thought on the significance of Technical Boy having 206 children. I don't subscribe to any of this bullshit, but there's an angel number that seems to fit into the show and aligns somewhat with Technical Boy. Angel number 206. Your faith in God and angels is solid. This ensures that your material needs are always fulfilled. Keep your faith strong and be open to receive what you created in your mind. Just a thought. Keep up the great work. Very interesting theory. And I don't know if Neil Gaiman has read the angel book, but he does know a great deal about apocryphal Western religious information. And then on Twitter, at Hey Jack Ryan says, 206 bones in the human body, like each child born from a bone. So two strong contenders, actually. I really like the 206 bones theory, but I did remark, I think, that it was sort of an oddly corporeal thing for the technical boy to have to glommed onto as a creation myth, if you will.
Yeah.
No answers from Neil yet.
No, yeah, Neil has not responded. No. So you can email us, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You can tweet at us. I'm at Joe Wrote This. Gail is at Clockwork Rose. We had a lot of people bringing up the 206 bones in the human body. Hey Jack Ryan just got extra credit for claiming to be an expert after one college course, I believe it was. Yeah, I really liked your answer that seems like a highly mythological answer, one child per bone in the body, but such a weird old world one for a modern god like the technical boy. That's why we were really hoping 206 would mean something in coding lingo. A lot
we
of people
assured by many experts.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
A lot of people on Twitter were like, no. So 206 bones in the human body, it may possibly be. I have another question for you guys. That I will pose later on that maybe you can sort of all rush to tell me I'm wrong about. But we are going to get to this episode, which, I mean, before we sort of run through it beat from beat, I thought this was a big, I liked the pilot, but I thought this was a big improvement on the pilot. What did you think, just vaguely, of the episode, Gail?
I thought it was a huge improvement on the pilot. The pilot left me sort of oddly cold, as much as I was so excited to see, you know, an interpretation. As I said, it was very literal in terms of what happened in the first couple chapters of the book. But this episode really veered off the path in a number of ways, which we'll get to. But it was also just like there were at least three scenes where I was just glued to the screen because the performance that was happening was fantastic. So, this one was a huge improvement for me. I'm just so excited for the rest of the show at this point. I was really excited to talk about this episode.
Okay, so we are going to start with what I would guess would be one of those performances, which is the cold open of this episode, one of those Coming to America vignettes that we've talked about last week. This one involves a character named Mr. Nancy, or Anansi, played by Orlando Jones. And we see him deliver this sort of show-stopping monologue on a slaver ship on his way to America. Mr. Nancy, we should say, or Anansi, we should say right off the bat, is the only character in American Gods to get a sort of official, full-fledged book spinoff called Anansi Boys. Mr. Nancy isn't really in Anansi Boys that much, but still, just so you know, this isn't the one and done for Mr. Nancy. Mr. Nancy is an important figure with a role to play. This monologue, however, is not in the books. The closest we get is a Coming to America vignette for another African trickster god named Alegba. But they gave Mr. Nancy quite a mouthful to say. What did you think of this scene, Gail?
It was so interesting because it was like the Viking scene was a deviation from the book, but this was a huge deviation from the Coming to America story that focused on, you know, African gods and in particular South African gods coming to America. The story in the book is really sad. Reread it today. It's really a difficult thing to read. This was also, you know, it was painful and terrible to see, but it was funny too. Like, Orlando Jones did such a good job. It was really funny. It was brutal and it was very stirring. It was a great, introduction to a trickster god also, because, you know, you have this man in the hold who is praying for salvation, and the answer he gets is, there isn't any for you, not the way you want it. There's no comfort, and there never will be, so you're going to have to make the hard choice right now. And while I care that that's happening to you, I'm not, like, sad about it. You know,
right, because we talked about last week, these gods demand blood and sacrifice for their power,
But also I think it's a good, you know, these Coming to America stories in the book are sort of, they're an explanation for how human beings, a lot of the Coming to America stories are full of pain and suffering and people clinging to something that came from the old country. And that's how, you know, the gods come over. I think that's a theme in those. And in this vignette, you know, there was a lot of pain and suffering, but the show seems to be using these as an introduction to different types of gods or different, you know, different cultures' gods. And I mean, trickster gods are in just about every culture. Native American culture has Coyote, and you know, there's Anansi, and there's Loki, and there's Hermes in the Greek pantheon. There's a lot, and you know, to a certain extent, Krishna as well. So there's all these sort of like happy-go-lucky gods, and then in Western fairy tales, you've also got, you know, characters who are lazy or they're sort of like just thieves, and we like those characters. But it's also important to remember, like, they will totally screw you over. Like, you can't trust them. It's a really important feature that you need to understand about trickster gods is, like, they will help you in their own way. And a lot of times in order that, like, there's a kickback for them.
Right.
So it was, I thought it was a really, it was a great introduction to Anansi, because there's like, there's a reason that people prayed to these gods, but it was sort of like, it's, they're like luck gods, like chance and circumstance, and it only gets you so far.
We talked last week about how Mad Sweeney has this interesting muddy Irish accent, and maybe that there is an explanation for that. And with Mr. Nancy, we get Orlando Jones sort of zooming between, I think it's about five different sort of accents and dialects.
Yeah,
and so he, cool. Yeah, he talked about how, you know, he's talked about how intentional it was that he wanted Mr. Nancy to speak the way like all of his followers would speak. And so, I just thought that was fascinating. And then, I know some book readers have had some issue with the fact that he's anachronistically dressed, that he seems to be almost like a time traveling god who knows what's going to happen to the black man in America. But I didn't mind that at all. I thought it looked great, because he looks that much more awesome. And I don't mean like awesome. I mean like full of awe to his followers when he appears in this like outrageous zoot suit sort of situation. So
The only thing I'll say to that is that if you look at the like original character of their gods, I think it's perfectly on point that the trickster god would speak in a way that his followers would be confused by. It's, you know, they people, you know, that those gods sort of personify, you know, it's sort of like he's talking to himself. He has some kind of insider trading knowledge in what's going to happen to everybody. But I did think it was to great effect, but yeah, it took me a little out of the story initially. The other thing is not to take away from the story that they're telling, but it was just sort of a timely speech, and I enjoyed the, I think the show was a little self-conscious in that moment, which again, it took me out of the story a little bit. But I mean, if I'd been one of the show writers and producers, I wouldn't have changed it. It was too great a scene, frankly, and it was too great an opportunity. And I thought for the character, it's appropriate for him to be a little weirder and more present than some of the other gods.
Yeah, when I talked to Orlando Jones, I interviewed him a couple months ago about this, I think it was, and he told me that when they were filming this up in Canada was sort of right in the heat of the presidential election last year, and that they were watching all these Trump rallies. And the comparison that he made was sort of like this rhetoric. I mean, not to get too political in this podcast, but like the rhetoric that he saw in those rallies, which he felt was convincing these followers to burn themselves alive, which is something that people talk about a lot in terms of like Trump supporters voting against their own interests in theory. You know, that's some people's interpretation of what happened with the election. And so, you know, he was like making this comparison between Trump convincing his followers to burn themselves alive and Anansi doing the same. And I was like, well, wow, damn. Who would have thought? American gods. So that's our introduction of Mr. Anansi, but it's not the last we will see of him.
And it was a powerful, again, reference to sacrifice. And it's just a really important theme to the story. And I there's another character I wanted to touch on a little later. There's going to be in every episode, I think, just a really strong connection to sacrifice.
So speaking of sacrifices, we then cut to Shadow, who is exactly just about where we left him, hanging in the rain. There's geysers of blood. And then we see Shadow getting stapled back together, I guess, at the hospital. He's got a wound in his side, Gail. could that mean anything in terms of deities?
Well, there is one notable deity who was definitely killed by other people on a tree of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe someone speared him in the side.
Mm-hmm.
I think his name was something Latin. Jesus, maybe? Anyway.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, so Shadow has a suspiciously godly wound in his side. And he goes back to the hotel or the motel where Wednesday's staying, bangs on the room. The room number is 109. I could not come up with any significance for that. But if you guys feel like there is one, let us know. And he talks about what happened to him. And, you know, like we sort of touched on last week, Shadow is not, you know, messing around with the language. He's like, that was a lynch mob. I was lynched. He makes reference to Strange Fruit, which is a famous Billie Holiday song about lynching. And, you know, Wednesday calls the technical boy a little asshole. And he says, an assault on you is an insult to me. And he doubles Shadow salary, which seems to mollify him a little bit. And that's that interaction. What do you think of making that particular, you know, I think it circles back to the Mr. Nancy thing and then will be echoed later in the episode, but making that particular act of violence so racially charged, you know?
I think they did the Strange Fruit reference, and I liked the way that Mr. Wednesday just sort of brushes it off, like, plucked fruit, plucky. I don't know, just sort of like...
Such a weird response.
I'm sure you're fine. don't burst a staple, Shadow. there was that reference, and then there was a later reference with another character who just says, you're black, right? And it's sort of like the show has just decided, okay, well, we're just, this character is black, and in this particular episode, you know, starting as they did with a black coming to America story, it just sort of seems like that's the direction we've taken with this character. And, you know, I think it's totally appropriate, especially in the context of this one episode.
We then see Shadow run himself a nice bubble bath, and it's one of my favorite visuals in anything ever. I don't know why. Is someone who's like too big for the tub that they're sitting in. Shadow is just this like hulking man in this tiny motel tub, trying to like relax, but you can't really soak if you like only your bottom half fits in the tub. Takes his wedding ring off, goes to sleep, and dreams of Laura. And then he wakes up wincing at the suspiciously placed wound at his side, and he cries a good deal. And I think this is, you know, this is good to take a beat and talk about what we said last week about this Shadow in the show being much more emotional than the Shadow in the book. And I think even more so in this episode than in previous, I feel like we get a lot more of Shadow's personality, both his charm and his sorrow in this episode. What did you think of that moment?
Yeah, he cries in the book as well, but it's sort of made a big deal of because it is like, I think like the first time in the book, and you're like 200 pages in, where he has shown any emotion at all, pretty much, aside from like a little anger from time to time because someone hit him. I felt very badly for Shadow at that moment. You know, it's, and especially the line that Laura has, she says, no, it's all a bad dream. And if you've ever had a tragedy in your life, you know how those moments happen, and you manage to, your brain just sort of says, well, this is too painful, it's probably not happening, and then no, it is.
we should talk about Laura's nickname for Shadow, which is Puppy, right? Which never really sat super well with me on the page, and sits even worse for me in the show.
I hate it
I hate it so much.
It's funny because Neil Gaiman is usually pretty good at inventing these quiet little histories for people. You know, these like odd little things that you put into a story, and they bring the character to life in certain ways. But that one just is terrible, and the story behind it, I don't even like either. It's kind of poignant because I think in the book they had wanted to get a puppy, but they couldn't because like their landlord wouldn't let them, and he was like, I'll be your puppy, and so yeah, that was his nickname forever. I don't think he was a very suitable puppy though.
No, like, but I mean, you like,
puppy's a terrible nickname.
I don't want to blow up your spot, but you've got a great nickname for your husband, and like, you know, that like people can have great affectionate, this really only makes sense to us, nicknames for each other that just work a lot better than puppy, which is just the worst. Okay, thank you. Glad you agree. All right. And then we see Shadow packing up his old house in record time. Like, someone tweeted...
Oh, thank you, because both... So I watched this episode with my husband, not a puppy, who was immediately like, there is no way that he packed up that house in one day. And I was like, I know, right? We've all moved. It didn't happen.
No, I mean, yeah, someone tweeted me today, like, is Shadow superpower packing up a house really fast? Because it's freaking insane.
If he was, he didn't have time to scrub her on the toilet. So let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, until he bled. No. But yeah, he packs up the house. He grabs Laura's ring. He looks at her phone. He finds the surprise that Robbie left there. And this, I mean, we should mention this because Brian Fuller said, you know, we're all quite used to cable nudity at this point. Like, the what we saw of Bill Quist in last week's episode and in this week's episode doesn't really surprise us because we've all seen a lot of Game of Thrones. But the male nudity that we'll see in the show, I think, has already surprised people. And Brian Fuller, you know, showrunner Brian Fuller said that Starz encouraged him to be as equal with the nudity as he possibly could. And so this dick pic, let's call it what it is, I think took people by surprise, but I'm just like, man, it's what we've been seeing from
only
women.
Only fair, guys.
It's only fair. So you get a fleeting dick. We get Dane Cook's penis, which is not the first penis I would have asked for, but there you go. And
is that whose penis that is?
Yes, Dane Cook's
no
penis.
Way.
Yep.
Dane Cook's cameo.
Dane Cook's lauded cameo.
The more you know.
And Wednesday's waiting for Shadow after he has packed up his house in record time and tells him he doesn't have to feel bad sort of because of, like, how things went down with Robbie and Laura. Like, basically, he shouldn't mourn so hard because of the infidelity and all of that. And then he picks a dandelion and sniffs it.
You don't smell like anything, by the way. That was odd.
They sure don't.
Okay, can we quickly go back?
Yeah.
Real quick to the DP, because I actually, like, when he flips through the phone and he sees that, I was just like, well, you know, I thought I didn't have any problem with the nudity because obviously this was personal conversations between two people who were having sex with each other, mm-hmm. and they were doing it, like, just for the sex too. So, you know, things, if you don't have time to delete your phone, then, well, that's a risky run. I mean, I think everyone watching that episode was like, better go through my search history just in case I die. But the one part of that scene that I did think, like, kind of ruined that moment, because I thought actually that moment was just fine the way that they did it, where, because Shadow had this look across his face. Ricky Whittle did a great job of sort of being like, well, you deserve that. You looked at the phone. You knew what you were going to find. You were going to find things you didn't want to see. But then he looks up at their wedding photo.
Right.
It's the dick pic again. And I was like, okay, I know what you were trying to say there, but I think you probably should have cut that part because that was just funny.
I agree. Like,
funny.
I think on the page it would have, I think it would have read really well. Like, oh, then.
And it had this, like, ominous musical cue.
Yeah, that it was like peanut. And it was framed oddly. And I don't know if my visual effects, if I got the finish. Sometimes on the screeners that I get, like, not all the visual effects are done. So maybe it looked better in the finished product. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, that was maybe one dick too far.
This is why we actually need more equality in nudity, is because dicks just look funny now. Like, you can't take them seriously because they're just never shown.
There you go.
Anyway.
No, I agree. I agree with you totally. So then we get Shadow Wednesday on the road, which, like, this is a road trip book and show. Mm. So the more Shadow Wednesday in the car, probably the better. Wednesday picks up asks Shadow about his coin tricks and basically, like, echoes what we were saying last week, which is like, you don't really have the personality for this. Like, you're kind of boring, bro.
You don't have a personality.
I don't know that you have the charm for a coin trick. And he also instructs Shadow not to take the highways. And he says, no highways, seen one, seen them all. But there's a question mark about whether Wednesday has a different reason for not wanting to take highways. And that has to do with sort of, mm-hmm. the new gods that he might be ducking, because in the book there are these car gods. And I'm going to read a brief description, which says, "There were car gods there, a powerful, serious-faced contingent with blood on their black gloves and on their chrome teeth, recipients of human sacrifice on a scale undreamed of since the Aztecs. Even they looked uncomfortable. Worlds change." So basically, I think the car gods get their power from all the, presumably, accidents on the road.
I was going to say that. I had forgotten about the car gods, but it immediately reminds me of a crash and... It's sort of Ballardian. I don't know if that's something he was referring to.
I don't know if I knew when we started this podcast that you would say Ballardian by the second episode, except here we are. And then Shadow just like straight up asks Wednesday his plan. And Wednesday says Wednesday is like, predictable doublespeak, says, "Meeting with people preeminent in their respective fields and then rendezvous at one of the most important places in the country." And then he says, "Opinions vary of what the most important place in the country is." And then we get the shadow and sound of a raven flying overhead. And then he says he's going to Chicago to get his hammer. And then the dandelion goes up the window into the sky. And then there's thunder and lightning. So I have two questions for you, Gil. Number one, I know people listening may not know that you are a crazy bird lady, but you are. So I know that you know that, you know, a raven flying overhead is because Odin has these two sort of raven familiars. It's two, right? That sort of
two
act as his spies and follow him around.
I believe they are called Hunir and Munir. I'll have to look that up. But their thought and memory are their names. In, you know, Norse.
So the raven is like, Odin, this is Odin, blah, blah, blah. But then I have to go get my hammer, and then the thunder and lightning, like, that feels to me like a Thor fake out.
Was very like, and we're segueing into a Marvel movie. Especially like the dandelion sort of electrifying, but it absolutely felt like a Thor fake out.
So that's my question for listeners is like, why do you think that dandelion thing exists? Why does that shot exist if not to be some sort of weird Thor fake out? And why are they bothering with fake outs at this point? Or am I just being unreasonable? Like, probably there's people watching this out in the country who like, are not dialed into the promo, not dialed into anything. They're just watching it without having read the books, and they don't know at this point that Mr. Wednesday is Odin, you know, which is something we said from the beginning that we would not be shy about what gods you're going to see. I don't know, but that Thor fake out felt really weird to me. We'll find out more about the hammer really quickly, but the thunder and lightning just, that was odd to me. So.
Really quickly, that scene... Creedence Clearwater starts to play as Mr. Wednesday, like, lovingly, you know, brushes his hand over the dashboard of his car. And he wants to go 60. He doesn't want to go too fast. And he wants to take all the back roads. Neil Gaiman tweeted, like, it was a really short little video on Instagram. I couldn't find any longer version of it, but it was him talking about taking this epic road trip when he decided he was going to write this book, American Gods, and he made a rule for himself that he wasn't allowed to take any major freeways. And so he took all these little back roads, and he talks about driving through these little tiny ghost towns and really seeing this small town character of America. There are kind of two Americas. There's big city America that's, you know, full of immigrants and full of lots of cultures and peoples and activities. And then there's America is freaking huge. And I have a limited similar experience with Neil Gaiman, because when I was a kid, my parents would take us on these really long road trips, and they would make a point of taking like Route 66 and all these out of the way places. We went through tons of ghost towns, and all these little, we would stay in these teeny tiny little towns all through the Midwest. And it's a completely different America. And any of you listeners who are living in these small towns will definitely know that. But I thought that was a really loving way to start this book. To really go out and try to know what you were talking about, especially since Neil Gaiman is not himself American. In a way, he's putting himself in the position of an alien or a visitor coming in and seeing what there was of this place and the character of this place, which is so much land compared to a lot of the places that in the context of this story, these deities and these immigrants would have been coming from.
Yeah, and Neil Gaiman has, in the introduction to the 10th anniversary issue, you can either read it or, as I have done, you can also listen to it on the audiobook format. Neil Gaiman himself, I believe, reading this essay that's at the beginning of the 10th anniversary edition, all about how he went about crafting. I don't know that I remembered that detail of him only taking back roads. That's so lovely. But he did talk about sort of the taking the train as well, and the various you know places he went and things he saw while he was writing the book, which I think really is a brilliant way for an outsider to write a novel about, you know, an adoptive country. So excellent. Well, yeah, and like it's right on theme with Neil Gaiman that he would sort of cast himself as Odin, right? Yeah, I think so. All right. Then we move from the old gods once again to the new. Wednesday goes to meet with someone while Shadow goes shopping at a big box store, and he meets someone there. This scene takes place in a hotel room, but Brian Fuller said in interviews that they kind of wanted to do this big box store setting because it's that sort of setting is historically disorienting for people who have been in prison for a long time. You know, if you've been penned up for a long time, going into one of those just like, I mean, it's disorienting for any of us, I think, to go into
those
places.
I've been in like an actual real Walmart where it's just like an ocean of products. I was like, am I ever leaving? Like,
do you remember the one were you with me when we went to the one in Bakersfield where I literally could not see the back wall of it? Yeah. I could not see the other side of the store. I
had like fallen through a hole in reality and there was nothing but Walmart anymore. And there was so much you could find, literally, like you could find anything in this place. And it was its own like kind of upsetting that you wouldn't have to like, I mean, yeah, it's convenient, but I mean, almost in walking distance, you're going just as far as if you had to go across town to get the thing. So like, why do we need to have it all in one store? Is it raining that hard?
There is no America. There's only Walmart. And that lady at that Walmart checkout was telling us how this was like the puny Walmart and they were building a bigger super Walmart across town. Remember?
Yeah. You could like buy cars and stay at night.
So yeah, meet your wife at Walmart. So, you know, so Shadow has got a shopping list. And eagle-eyed viewers have pointed out that he looks at the shopping list. We see the items on there. Weirdly, on the list, it says two cell phones, which Wednesday later tosses out the car window. So one theory is that maybe Wednesday dictated the list and Shadow himself made the note to get two cell phones. Or otherwise, I don't know what to tell you about why Wednesday would ask for two cell phones and then throw them out the window. But
to make a point, that's maybe like a slightly Wednesday thing to do. It's a little weird, but that was another part of that road trip. Like, in addition to staying away, like, what's he hiding from on the big roads? Like, well, why doesn't he want a cell phone? Well, he's also hiding from other stuff. Let's face it.
Right. Very true. But then why have them in the first place? Okay. So, but Shadow meets the god of media, played by the lovely Gillian Anderson as Lucille Ball, or really Lucy Ricardo. She shows up in black and white for most of the scene and a little bit in color in, I think, one of the greatest moments in the episode, because I bet you that 75% of the people watching the episode were looking at another smaller screen when she was like, look at other screens so as not to get bored. And then she does the point and she transitions into color. And you're like, damn it, she caught me. She caught me second screening. And she talks about something we talked about last week, which is sort of time and attention. And she has the great line where she says, it's better, time and attention, better than lamb's blood. They sit side by side, ignore each other and watch me. And how her screen is the altar. And she says, we are now and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And like the technical boy, but just in a nicer way, she tries to draft Shadow to her side. What did you think of this?
First of all, I love Gillian Anderson so much. And I do think that she is objectively gorgeous. She just looked wonderful as Lucy Ricardo. But she also, I don't know, like I think I've seen Gillian Anderson play so many very serious characters, and she has this beautiful, like, you know, sort of unlined, beautiful, still face that she just plays these very serious characters with. I mean, Scully was pretty humorless, and her character in The Fall, and then she's done a number of period pieces where she tends to have these very serious characters. And I loved her intro in this episode because she got to, I mean, she did a pretty decent Lucy impression. I thought it was pretty good. And, and she had this sort of familiar and just a little seductive way of talking to Shadow. I thought she did a fantastic job. The continual flipping of the screens and the enlarging of her face as she, like, towered over Shadow and stared down at him, and, like, the screens on either side of him sort of consuming his attention, walling him in. And straight talk during that scene, I have been airdropping my stars onto my Apple TV. So I can't use my phone while I am watching the episode, or the episode stops. And it was either shortly before or during that scene that I, like, remembered, oh, right, I was going to text someone, picked up my phone, and drew everything to a grinding halt because I, like, couldn't wait another, 20 minutes to text someone. I had to do it right then. So it was sort of a weird meta moment for me.
I got you.
And she got me.
She
was sort of like, she was sort of honeyed as she was talking to him. And it is a very seductive kind of thing, you know, our constant information and entertainment that we have always available to us. It just sort of sucks you in. Mm-hmm. She did a great job of channeling that.
And she has that great iconic line, which is also in the book, which is, have you ever wanted to see Lucy's tits? And and, like, when you're reading it, you're like, no, oh my God. Like, Lucy Ricardo is this icon of, like, you know.
Wholesomeness.
Like, she's beautiful. Like, I mean, Lucille Ball is beautiful, but, like, when she was Lucy, I don't know, it's just something else where you're like, it's perverse. You're like, no, I don't want to see Lucy's tits. And it's a little
Lucy
different.
Would never.
I know. It's a little different when it's Gillian Anderson. You're like, well, maybe. I don't know. And I like what you said about how, you know, the walls of TV were almost consuming him. Like, this is a much more dynamic way to do this scene than just a TV in a motel room. And these are sort of some of the advantages that the TV series has, where it can go dazzling with the visuals in a way that, you know, the book doesn't always need to. Sometimes to better effect than other, we'll get to sort of one of the ones that I think doesn't work later, but she also says, guys like you end up a suicide every time. I'm trying to help you keep your neck out of the belt. So that's a fun thing to say. So, so Shadow, get the fuck out of there.
Oddly threatening.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, it's definitely threatening.
You know, like, but it was, she's, I'm trying to help you, honey. I would never do that to you, honey.
Yeah.
Guys like you end up, you know, just like, you're going to do this to yourself.
I would never. I would never, but it might happen to you. Yeah. So Shadow gets out of there. He go back and find Wednesday in the diner. Wednesday having met with what we know is an ifrit, and you can tell that by the flames in his eyes. We'll get to more of that later. And it feels like Shadow is really coming to terms with it. You know, we talked about this last week. Shadow really coming to terms with the shit that's going on around him. Wednesday says the world is either crazy or you are. Basically, sort of. What is happening? What is going on? And then Shadow talks about how media and the technical boy both sort of threaten to reprogram reality. Mm. And Brian Fuller said this really interesting thing in an Entertainment Weekly interview where he says, well, we're witnessing a reprogramming of reality happening right now, where truth is no longer currency that people are trading in, and facts are meaningless, and feelings have replaced substantial truths in a way that I feel like there is an assault on reality right now happening in America politically that is probably not too far disconnected from the reprogramming of reality that the new gods are threatening, because what they are attempting to do is control the game in a way that is not beholden to anybody else's opinion but their own. And that's just something that I obviously had never thought about when I first read the book. Seems to be a sign of the times. You know, we are forever needing to be, you know, even taking politics out of it, we are forever needing to be cautious about like sort of what we repost on Facebook or what we retweet, because videos can be manipulated, stories can be slanted. You know, people are just on both sides of the aisle are forever spreading fake news, and that is mm-hmm. a manipulation of that's rewriting reality. So
yeah, and you know, it's interesting, you know, when we talk about reality, because a long-standing tenet of all mythologies is and in particular I would say like, you know, the Greek mythologies, the gods are always very conscious that people have to believe in them. They have to sacrifice to them, or they cease to be relevant. They cease to exist. And it's interesting, you know, for humanity to have created beings and then set these rules for them. And there's an admission in the show and in the characters that they were created in a way by humans, and they don't have the choices that people have about what they do and who they are. They have to have sacrifice or they cease to be. And they have to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal to make it happen for them. But the new gods do seem to have this idea that they're above that in a way, that they can create their own sacrifice by tricking and lying and seducing people. And you don't get quite the same impression from the old gods. There's something a little more desperate about the old gods, in my opinion.
Absolutely. We will get to one of those very desperate old gods in a second. first, yeah, I just want to underline what you said earlier, which is that Wednesday throws those two cell phones out the window. you know, which might be, you know, dodging the ever-present eye of the technical boy. You know, don't let technology into your life if there's a technical god sort of hot on your heels. But it also might be a show convenience thing. This is something that comes up a lot when people talk about the X-Files and the rebooted X-Files, which is like the X-Files and a lot of actually like old movies couldn't exist now because we all have cell phones in our pockets all the time, mm-hmm. right? And so if Mulder and Scully had cell phones with cameras in them in their pockets in the first season of X-Files, like they would have snapped photos of those aliens and it would have been series over like every time. And so when they rebooted it last year, they like Mulder and Scully had to like keep losing their phone. Like they had to do something about these cell phones because it's just like it ruins the premise of like, oh, I think I saw a thing, but I have no proof of it. So, I you know, this is not a spoiler. I'm just saying like, it might be that in this story that's set in 2001, originally it would behoove, the plot for Shadow and Wednesday not to have a convenient way of getting a hold of each other. That's really not a spoiler. It's just a question mark.
It's an explanation, I guess, for, yeah, what the way that they're going to conduct a lot of the rest of the travel and communication. And actually, you know, like it could turn out to be really well played because, you know, Odin, he has a good reason for not wanting to be too well connected, especially through technology. But at the same time, there's a sentimentality, which could be just an excuse on his part. But, you know, he's a romantic in a lot of ways, for a, you know, blood sacrifice kind of guy. But he plays up the romanticism of, you know, opening the telegram and opening it slowly because, you know, you don't know what's in it. It's a surprise. And then, you know, choosing your words very carefully because you had to pay for every one. So, yeah, I think they did a good job of representing it like, well, this is a practicality and also a quirk.
He's a romantic, but it depends if you ask that girl's mother in the motel.
It's true.
Okay, so speaking of desperate old gods, we revisit good old Bilquis in this episode. We get a sex montage, a sexy montage. We find out that Bilquis does not, you know, confine herself to gentleman callers. She is an equal opportunity devourer. Mm-hmm. And then she does. You know what the scene struck me as? It's like in Sunset Boulevard, when the main character in Sunset Boulevard, this washed up actress, is like watching her old movie.
Yeah.
You know, Bilquis goes and revisits her glory days when people made statues of her and she mm-hmm. had glorious gold body jewelry and stuff like that. She goes to visit a museum exhibit, you know, so... I guess the more relatable thing is like what us flipping through old Facebook photos to see what we were like in college. I don't know, like something like really, you know, funny,
yeah,
you know.
No, I had a lot of thoughts about that actually, that scene, because Bilquis is, you know, eating people. They look pretty happy about it, but at the same time, like, they're leaving behind their families and lives. She's eating people. And she's doing it in a sort of duplicitous way. She is conning sacrifice out of them. Whereas in the old days, people would have known that she was the deity, that, you know, that their lust was offered up to, or their beauty was beholden to, or whatever, you know, whatever her individual responsibility was as a love and lust goddess. I'll be honest with you, I don't know very much about that particular deity, but I found that scene very poignant because, you know, after you've watched her eat any number of people, she goes into that room and yeah, she looks at the statue and she's so beautiful, by the way, in that scene, the way that they've pulled her hair back so that it's just her beautiful, symmetrical face. She's just lovely. And she just manages to speak volumes in the quietude of her face as she looks at that statue and she considers it from all these angles and she gets quite close to it. And then she goes and she looks at the jewelry. And initially she looks sort of like she's having, you know, a pleasant reminiscence about this. And she looks at the jewelry and her face seems to sadden. And then there creeps into her aspect a sort of quiet resolve, like maybe I don't need to let go of this quite yet. Maybe I could reclaim some part of this. I don't have to keep subsisting off of this trickery and, you know, these random handouts. I don't know, she's not a good or admirable character per se. Obviously, like, she's, you know, tricking people into, you know, being eaten by her vagina. But at the same time, I think, again, not to get too political, it pointed up the fact that in a lot of cultures, and I would venture to say a majority of cultures, there is an inordinate amount of value placed on a woman's appearance. And if that is the deity that you are made, if that's all she is, because people have a choice what they put their faith in and what they put their worship in. If you choose to focus all your attention on your appearance, then that's like you're sacrificing any number of other things you could be paying attention to. So, you know, in a way you're sacrificing to that, whatever deity. If you, you know, historically, like if you had a pantheon and you wanted to focus all your attention on being strong or all your attention on any of the other things that, or being wealthy,
being clever,
whatever it was. But the, like I said before, in this story, the gods don't get to choose who they are. They are created that way and that's what they live on. And so people deciding what they choose to sacrifice to or what they choose to pay attention to are good or bad in our estimation, or, you know, better or worse, relatively, based on, you know, what they choose to focus the majority of their attention on. But the gods, in their own way, they're sort of neither good nor bad. They just are what they are. And she can't help it. That's what she is. And if she wants to survive, that's what she got to do. And, you know, and I thought it was sort of poignant because at one time it was easier for her to be who she was. And now it's really hard.
Yeah, and I really like what you say about, like, you know, we see her crying. Like, she looks sort of beautiful and glowing in her bed and, like, you know, the afterglow of devouring all these people. But she's crying because, like, you know, it doesn't – there's no joy in snuffing out these lives for her. There's only survival, right?
Yeah.
But I like what you say about sort of, in theory, once upon a time – I mean, you know, Bilquis is based on the Queen of Sheba. The Queen of Sheba sort of Bilquis – tradition's a little fuzzy, but, like, let's say in the premise of this world, once upon a time, the sacrifices she had were made, as you say, sort of like willingly and knowingly by the person, right? Someone who chooses to worship Bilquis, they sacrifice people to her, in theory, you know, so that sacrifice coming willingly rather than her having to trick people into it, of course that's more desirable. So yeah, I really like the book was seen. The showrunners have talked about how, and this is definitely true, that the book is a little thin on the ground when it comes to female characters of any significance. You've got, I mean, I would say Laura is significant, and then you meet some of these deities. We're about to meet a couple of them, but I think that one of the reasons that they beefed up the Bilquis presence in the show is to try to balance the scales a little bit in terms of gender representation, because a lot of the gods we meet are male, so that's just
true. Yeah.
All right, so then we get to Chicago. We're in Chicago already. Oh, and this is the visual thing that I wanted to say that I didn't like, which is the map turning into this, like, lock and key sort of imagery. Like, that's the kind of visual that I just, it doesn't land well with me. I don't think it's beautifully done. I don't know. It didn't work for me. So, but we're in Chicago and we've got this, rundown, shabby little apartment, and there lives Chernabog, and with Chernabog are the three, sisters, Zariah, all named Zariah. Are you ready? Are you ready for me to butcher their names? Zariah Vechernaya.
Better you than me.
Zariah Utranaya and Zariah Polonochnaya. The eldest is played by Cloris Leachman, the middle played by Martha Kelly, and the youngest we have yet to meet. She's played by a Polish actress named Erica Carr. Martha Kelly, I just want to give a shout out to Martha Kelly. It took me, like, a really long time to realize where I know her from, which is the FX show Baskets, where she is absolutely charming. But she's mostly silent sister in this episode, and it's mostly Cloris Leachman's show, and she is freaking amazing. Cloris Leachman, she's
so wonderful.
Cloris Leachman turned 90 years old while was filming her episodes of American Gods, and Brian Fuller says that he had a cake made for her that said "I'm fucking 90" on it or something like that, like, at her request. Anyway, Cloris Leachman is a pip. These are Slavic deities, these sisters, and they are based on, they represent the stars, the morning star, the evening star, and then Gaiman actually invented the third one, Polonochnaya, which is the midnight star. Really, please do forgive me if you are Eastern European and listening to me slaughter these names. I really do apologize, but yeah, so these are Slavic goddesses, and they live with this figure of Chernabog, who is also a Slavic god. So basically, you know, they talk about being family and that they're not actually related to each other, but they came over together is what Cloris Leachman's character says. And that's because, you know, they were all, you know, had the same following. There's a huge Russian Jewish and Russian, you know, Russian in general population in Chicago in the early days of Chicago. And then also, of course, the slaughterhouses were a big part of the early days of Chicago. So the fact that Chernabog sort of gets the blood that he needs on the slaughterhouse floor should come as no surprise. And we find out that when Wednesday was talking about his hammer, he was talking about Chernabog as his hammer, because Chernabog has this massive, scary hammer. So, for me, I will just step in front of you and say, for me, of all the great casting in this show, I think Peter Stormare as Chernabog is the most, like, well, I said that last week about Ian McShane. I don't know, maybe they're tied, but oh,
but you know what?
Just the scene right between out of the page. The
two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
It would be a hard call.
Perfect. And we get, you know, you might have reread this chapter more recently than I, but we get this really, you know, I don't think it could exist in the book because it's based on Shadow being black, but we get this really awkward dinner table conversation with Peter Stormare's Chernabog acting as sort of like your racist immigrant grandpa who like says things and you're like, grandpa, but he's like, what? You're my black friend. It's fine. But
and the funny thing is Cloris Leachman is sitting at the table and her character is just going, ugh. Both the sisters are like, do you have to?
Why?
You came over too long ago. You don't have an excuse anymore.
But it's important to, you know, he talks about how he was sort of, his brother was the white one. His brother in the mythology is Beelzebub. And he was the black one. Chernabog and Beelzebub literally mean black god and white god. So Chernabog would be the black god. Chernabog is a god of chaos and night and death. And Beelzebub is a god of luck and happiness and order. So these are the, they're sort of the, like the yin and the yang. And yeah, so like, you know, sort of threading that racial theme throughout the episode, I thought was really fairly interesting and not something that exists in the book, but it's just sort of like a tidy way to hit those spots a couple times in the same episode. Yeah.
You know, also something that was, and this is a very small detail, but I thought it was done to great effect. During the Bilquis montage, the Bob Dylan song, yes. Hard Rain Gonna Fall, yeah. was playing, and there's a line in that song, and it says, I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding, and then there's that amazing visual of, Peter Stormare holding the enormous, pocked, misshapen sledgehammer, and it's just like blood is just coursing down out of the hammer. I thought that was just sort of well played. Another little thread that they put in there.
Yes, I love right. it.
I found myself an American Gods playlist on Spotify. I'll tweet it out to you guys. It was really good. It's got everything so far.
The title of the episode, Secret of Spoons, comes from this made-up song that Brian Fuller wrote for Chernabog to sing when they're playing checkers. Mm. And it's sort of the song sort of deals with, I think it's sort of like paying respect to the cows that come before you or something like that. I really haven't yet sussed what Secret of Spoons means other than it's a lyric in this made-up song, but there you go. Yeah, and so we get Chernabog challenging Shadow to a game of checkers, which, you know, as fans of mythology and fairy tale will know, is like, a, you know, a classic thing, a challenge, a game, a wager. And the stakes...
A wager.
And the stakes couldn't be higher. Well, actually, before we get to that, we should say that Cloris Leachman has my favorite line and line delivery of the episode, which is... Tea is disgusting.
I loved that. I was like, yes.
I mean, we both like tea, but still. Just tea.
I like tea, but I prefer coffee. And I was just sort of like, yeah, I don't get the cult of tea. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't get the cult of tea. I get an occasional refreshing beverage, but I don't get
like, I had tea today.
An entire
cabinet. But at the
cabinet.
Same time, yeah, don't no. suggest that they're, yeah, no.
And... And the Soraya sisters read coffee grounds instead of tea leaves. Cloris Leachman's character obviously, like, clearly lies to Shadow and says, you have happy life with children or whatever. And, you know, and then he can tell that they're lying. And she says, your mother died of cancer? You no die of cancer. So it's all...
you die of something else terrible.
You die awful. Maybe in belts, media was talking about that.
But not cancer.
But no cancer. So so all that happens. What do you... You know, some book readers were sort of wondering what you think they see in the grounds. I saw nothing... some people guess that what they saw was the Thunderbird, which is a thing that will sort of play into later in the season. Mm-hmm. But do you have any thoughts?
You know, without spoiling anything, I like you. I saw nothing, But what I was looking for was a tree. So that's as spoilery as I will get. Okay. I didn't see one, though.
Yeah, I rewound it, and I was like, what is that?
I was like, it's a black dog. No, it's a giraffe.
I know. The black dog is very, very Harry Potter, but I saw none of it. So, okay, so we should get back to the wager, which is Chernabog's wager over a game of checkers while Shadow reads the newspaper casually in the background. Which I loved that part where he's like, how about the wager? And Shadow sort of wrestles and he goes, no, this is not your game. Like, you shut up.
But it was also a very like, you know the rules.
Yeah.
So sit down.
Sit down. Shut up.
He's in the game.
He entered the game choice. Willingly. His too choice. Late. Too late. Okay. So he says, if Shadow wins, Chernabog says he will go with, and he says Votan, which is the Slavic for Odin. He will go with Votan on, you know, to wherever he is going. And if he loses, if Shadow loses, Chernabog gets to bash his head in with his mighty hammer, one blow.
And he's just been over in detail exactly how that works.
Yeah.
So we're all really clear on how Shadow will die quickly and not angry.
Yeah, docile like a cow. So his
and
anger,
he will willingly go down on his knees.
So his anger doesn't you know, spill into his meat. Yeah, there you go. So there we go. And we've got how does that game of checkers end, Gail?
Shadow loses.
So stay tuned to next week in American Gods when our hero dies.
Brain's knocked out.
Definitely going to die next week.
Me probably untainted.
Yeah, so that's episode 2 of American Gods. And did you have any other like points or questions or comments or concerns about this episode?
I think I really covered everything that I had it burning in my hot little brain.
Okay, I hope you all enjoyed our terrible Russian accents or from wherever we're from. We're gonna add a new segment to this episode, which is just like a little spoilery segment.
What if we did the spoilery segment in terrible accents? Like every time a new one. No, that's a bad idea. We won't do that. I'm just kidding. We might, a little.
We might. Okay. But yeah, so if you stay tuned until after this spoiler warning, we're gonna look forward a little bit. But up until now, you've been safe. If you want to reach us, you can always find us stormofspoilers@gmail.com, at Joe Wrote This on Twitter, at Clockwork Rose on Twitter, at Storm of Spoilers on Twitter, all of that. Thank you for listening. And now we get into spoilers. Are you ready? Here we go. Are you really ready? Okay, here we go. So this is sort of like a fun little slightly spoilery, slightly not section that we're doing. I was listening to Neil Gaiman give this interview to the Empire Magazine podcast where he talked about how, like George R. R. Martin before him, and we know how well that turned out, he has told the showrunners of American Gods, Brian Fuller and Michael Green, what is important in the American Gods sequel book that he's writing. Now, a couple things. First of all, he's actually not currently writing the American Gods sequel. He's actually says he's writing, I think it's, yeah, Neverwhere, a sequel.
Ugh, that's a very George R. R. Martin move.
I know. No, he was very self-aware about it. He's like, I know I should be furiously working on this. Instead, I'm writing what nobody asked for, which is a Neverwhere sequel, because it's what I want to do. But I've been planning this American Gods sequel sort of since I wrote the first American Gods. And when I wrote the first American Gods, knowing I wanted to write a sequel to it, I sort of seeded in all these little references and things that would pay off in the next book. So that means when Brian Fuller and Michael Green were making the Starz version of American Gods, Neil Gaiman would occasionally be like, oh, no, you can't cut that character. I know they don't seem important, but they're going to be important later on. You know, so Brian Fuller and Michael Green know more than the rest of us do about what's to come in this American Gods verse. And so as such, you know, I thought it might be a sort of fun thought exercise to look at this season, look at the things that are included in an episode where you're like, huh, why did that detail make it and all these other things didn't? And like, maybe that's because it will be in a future book. One such sort of thing is Chernabog's whole thing about his brother, Beelzebub, and you know, and he also refers to his history with Wednesday, and he says, "You brought that madness into my life once, never again." And in an interview, Brian Fuller said that that is there because he says, "It was a moment where we both looked at each other," and he's talking about himself and Michael Green. "It's a moment we both looked at each other and said, we've got to unpack that in season two." So Chernabog backstory in season two. But that, I mean, that doesn't really count because season two will still be covering like the main plot of American Gods.
Right.
It's my understanding that season one will end at the carousel and season two will pick up after the carousel. So so was there anything in these two episodes that you're kind of like, or any adaptation choice at all, I guess, that you're kind of feeling, huh, about or interested in?
You know, that particular moment, I have to admit, I don't remember what the thing is. It in the book?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know a little bit about those particular, that tiny little pantheon there, those Czech gods and, or Russian gods. And I know, quite a bit more about the Norse pantheon, and there are some striking similarities actually, and you know, Chernabog and his not sisters are based on these constellations, and there's I think in the book Gaiman refers to it as a bear in the sky that is chained between the stars, and they have to be constantly vigilant and constantly watching him to make sure that he doesn't escape. And there are some similarities in Norse mythology and also with the brothers. You know, there's the Norse god Balder, who is the god of all that is bright and light and good and gentle and noble. And in Norse mythology, Loki manages to trick Hod, Odin's blind son, into killing Balder with the only thing on earth that can harm him. And it's a dreadful treachery, and it leads to Loki's fall from grace. But then there's also a couple other parallels. There's Fenris, the gigantic, or Fenrir as he's called a lot of times, the gigantic wolf who is Loki's son, who is permanently chained until Ragnarok. By the trickery, by the gods lying to him, which is a dreadful thing for the Norse gods to do. They were very, very much opposed to lying, which actually, sorry, like I'm getting sort of pedantic here, but actually if we want to talk about like the characters of the gods, that's a significant thing about the way that Gaiman has written Odin in America is he lies and he cheats all the time. And it was very antithetical to the way that the Norse saw their gods. They were violent and they killed people and took the stuff that they had, but they were pretty straightforward about it too. Lying and trickery was not something that was very much part of that culture. Additionally, in the Norse idea of the way that the sky and the stars and the sun and the moon operate, is sort of similar to the Greek pantheon. There were a couple of, in Norse mythology, there are two horses carting around the sun and the moon. Or there are four horses, two horses to a chariot, and they've got the sun in one and the moon in the other, and they're being chased around the sky by two huge wolves who are actually Jotuns who have turned themselves into wolves and are trying to devour the light out of the sky.
So what you're saying is that you think that Chernabog is referencing something like that happened in the old country, blend of their mythology, whereas my interpretation is it was like something that happened in the history, like that all this is sort of a battle star, all this has happened before and will happen again, like that Odin has in the American history tried to pull off what he's going to pull off now before and roped Chernabog into it before.
And I think that there's something to be said for either interpretation. You know, I obviously those two groups of gods, you know, in the individual mythologies had nothing to do with each other, as is characteristic of mythologies. But I also like trying to, you know, go through American history and figure out like what's the point at which there would have been some, I don't know, cataclysmic event when two two gods would have had at it. What could possibly have expressed itself in American culture or history?
The
Gaiman is referencing.
The 1906 earthquake. The Chicago fire.
The Chicago fire. Good one. A cow kicked over a lantern.
Yeah.
Like a mad cow, an angry cow kicked over a lantern.
So, you know, some options for season, like I feel like what they're doing, if this season does end with the carousel, as I think I've been told, which happens, would you say, a quarter of the way through the book or a third of the way?
I think a third of the way. Yeah.
You know, and this is the big revelation where Shadow sees the gods both as their sort of humanoid form that he's met. And then as their, you know, crazy, you know, godlike form. So, Anansi would be Orlando Jones, and then he would be a giant spider, right? Like that's what you see. And it sort of confirms at that point in the book, it confirms once and for all, you know, that Shadow then understands what he's dealing with. Up until then, he doesn't really understand.
Right.
So the option for season, if that is how this season ends, the option for season two gloves off about what we're dealing with, an option to sort of flesh out the story are sort of divine backstories. And I'm not even talking about the Coming to America vignettes. I'm talking about some of this mythology.
Old country.
Yeah, old country stuff. Some of this mythology stuff that you're talking about. And that might be, I mean, that is pure 1000% speculation. But it might be a fun thing to sort of see old country versions of Odin or whomever else doing what they used to do, you know.
And you know, super super spoilery, like at the end of the book, Shadow has an encounter with old country Odin, who is a very different picture from American New World, tricky, shady, kind of sleazy Odin. He is he has a much nobler aspect, and he is kindlier looking, and he has a dignity about him that the American Odin didn't have. It was all about, you know, sort of crude power and the need to have more of it. And yeah, I mean, that would be an interesting contrast. I don't know that would be something. That would be a really interesting deviation. I think that might give away a little bit more of the game, actually, if they were to do that during the show.
That's good. That's a good point. And it also might just be a show that, like, you and I would want to watch, but maybe other people don't want to watch. Basically, like, Jim Henson's Storytellers, but about, like, old world gods or Hercules and Xena or whatever it is.
I would mind if Neil Gaiman decided to write about that in the fabled Second Coming book. So.
Well, what's fascinating is that in that same Empire magazine conversation, Neil Gaiman talks about how when he wrote American Gods, and he said this elsewhere, but when he wrote American Gods, he did so after that long stint. He had a long stint in Hollywood where he was trying to write screenplays and sort of butting up against the Hollywood system of like people who didn't actually really respect storytelling and just wanted sort of like fast and big and loud and whatever. Hey, you're the guy who writes the stories, writes a story that's big and fast and people will eat popcorn too and sit in their seats. Hey, hey. And Neil Gaiman's like, fuck you, I'm an artiste. And so he said that he wrote American Gods so that it was intentionally like impossible to adapt. And so you get these like weird little vignettes stuffed through, you know, he's like, I just put little short stories in there and it's like, well, what are you going to do about it? And he's like, and now we're trying to adapt it. So, I thought that was like a really interesting self-aware, you know, perspective on the really difficult task that he wound up setting himself, his future self.
He sort of shot himself in the foot there, but silver lining, I think it's actually, you know, just when I referenced earlier in this podcast, the fact that the United States of America is a really big piece of land, and you can't, I mean, even in the short time that the United States has been the United States, you can't have a really unified culture. You can have some aspects that we recognize internationally as American, you know, in attitude and culture. And unfortunately, just because of the amount of media and the direction that we've taken, a lot of those aspects are deplorable. But that's maybe an overused word right now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there are, however, and this is something that I think people who haven't lived in or visited a lot of parts of the U.S., it's difficult to get your head around. There are very distinct cultures within the U.S. And one of the things that I think is really great about the way that that American Gods is told is all these little vignettes, all these little side stories and bits and pieces. That's as accurate a representation of U.S. culture as you're going to get, because it is a lot of bits and pieces. And you'd be surprised at how isolated those cultures can be from each other. Even in the information age, there are still really strong cultural differences between, for example, a person who's grown up in Chicago and a person who has grown up in San Francisco. Those are really different cities in a lot of ways. And even more so, someone who grew up in Philadelphia and someone who grew up in Austin. So yeah, I like those little vignettes, because as much as it may have been an intentional attempt to overcomplicate the story, mm-hmm. it's a really complicated place taken as a whole. And I think the only way you're going to, and here's another thing, and this is a big sidebar. If you grew up in the U.S. and you went to grade school, which hopefully you did, you will know that wherever you grew up in fourth grade, that is the part of American history that you studied. And you did not study American history from any of the other places that other fourth graders are studying American history. And the reason that this is significant is, that's not like really, I think, explained to a lot of people growing up in the U.S. And so you have this sort of...
Are you telling picture. Me children in Philadelphia didn't do California mission projects in fourth grade?
I am telling you that they studied something else entirely from their weirdo city, whatever...
Like, they crafted models of the Liberty Bell.
And, you know, they were judged on the accuracy of the crack.
The accuracy of the crack is definitely the name of my memoir. So, you know what's weird about me? Sorry, we've just, like, kind of lost the thread. You're getting some weird bonus content. But, like, what's weird about me is that I transferred from Montessori school I went through fourth grade in Montessori school, and then fifth grade started in a sort of more parochial school. And I skipped the California Mission Project. And on my Montessori school, they did it in fifth grade, and all other schools they did it in fourth grade, and I didn't do it at all. So what? I'm like,
you know, it's illegal to pick the poppies, right?
I did learn that. I know all about the California poppies. No, but you're right. And it's a Well, it's a diversity that, you know, it's a weird use of the word diversity, but it's an individual culture that I think is being erased by, let's say, the new gods of media and technology, where, like, a lot of people feel like they almost live online now. So you don't, that individual California culture or Philadelphia culture or whatever it may be is, I think, eroding a bit, and we are becoming more homogenized. We'll never be entirely homogenized because we're too big of a country, but, but you're right that Gaiman does a great job in this book of, it has to be sort of shaggy and complicated and different styles sort of crammed together. And you, like, take this large deviation to, like, follow this Irish, criminal immigrant in her whole story, you know, and you have to, because that is America. That's what he's captured here. So,
yeah. And to that point, for those who were listening to the last podcast and were trying to figure out what I was referring to, when Joanna asked me, you know, what it was that I was most looking forward to in the series, it was very much the Henselman reveal and the Kobold storyline, which is a perfect example of, a sort of independent storyline. I mean, it drives the action of the story, but it would not be difficult, I think, to erase it in favor of the larger God War storyline. And it's very much centered on America's small townness and the sort of Midwestern religion that we have around the small town that came out of the way that we're built in this country.
Disappears into the small town for a while. Mm-hmm. So that's a great point. All right, we should probably wrap up. I will say one last thing, which is that if you want to read more about Neil Gaiman's thoughts of his time being a frustrated screenwriter in Hollywood, you should read The Goldfish Pool and Other Stories, which is a story in the collection Smoke and Mirrors, where he is just clearly working out his issues with Hollywood. Which, you know, Hollywood, he's definitely later come to embrace when he, you know, he's done Coraline and Stardust and a number of other sort of adaptations and obviously
more American Gods. On the head, yeah.
But, you know, for a time he felt quite misunderstood. And yeah, once again, Gail, where can people find you?
I am at Clockwork Rose on Twitter.
I'm at Joe Wrote This. You can email us at stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Until next week, only the gods are real.
You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down.